Welcome to the 24/7 Sports College Football Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson and Barton Simmons. The ultimate insider's guide from signing day to the national championship game and everything in between. CBS Sports presents the 24/7 Sports College Football Podcast.
Back here on the 24/7 Sports College Football Podcast, Chip Patterson, Barton Simmons, you know what it is. We've got a big week ahead. We've got guests, Barton, we've got guests.
Yeah, we got 24/7 flexing our muscles, bringing in one of the all-time greats in the network, the great Wes Rucker at 24/7 Sports. Go Vols 247. This is the time to talk balls because, man, it is an interesting time to be in Knoxville.
It is an interesting time to be in Knoxville, and that is the theme of this show because the Tennessee program, the Tennessee 2017 outlook is full of questions. And that's why our theme for this show, Barton, is about the big questions. It's about the camp is starting, the pads are popping, and we are talking about the questions that we have. So we are going to pitch back and forth before we get to Wes Rucker of Go Vols 24/7. We're going to do our big questions for this week. All right, big questions for this week. Barton, you get to go first. Let's go.
Okay. Let's go to the national championship Clemson Tigers because here's what I know about the Clemson Tigers.
Here's what we know. They got that ring.
They got a ring. They have the best defensive line in the country, and they have the talent in that program and on that field to run it back again and win another national championship.
But Deion Kane ain't going nowhere. He's still there.
But, Wes, who's going to get Deion Kane the football? And that's where the real question lies. And right now, heading into the fall, I guess you're going to call Kelly Bryant the starting quarterback. But it's very much a competition. It's wide open.
As I tell these guys all the time, there's no lifetime contracts. You got to be the best guy. All the time.
You got Kelly Bryant, you got redshirt freshman Zarek Cooper, and you have true freshman Hunter Johnson, who some called one of the best quarterbacks in last year's class. He was highly rated, highly regarded, highly recruited. And man, this is ultimately a quarterback that's going to emerge out of this race that has a chance to lead this team to a national championship. So my question is, A, who's it going to be? B, when are we going to figure that out? And C, is that guy going to be good enough to take this team where it can go?
Ooh, all right. So a couple reactions to this. Number one, we've got to remember that when Deshaun Watson had some health issues that prevented him from playing 12 games during his first season actively at Clemson. But at the same time, we're going to start cold stout against Georgia, but then even when Deshaun comes in and throws a ball on a friggin' rope, we're going to still stick with Cole Stout. That, for me, Barton, is going to make me think that Kelly Bryant is going to be the starter. He's going to be the starter for game one. They got their warm-up game. Game two is going to be Auburn in Death Valley. I think that Kelly Bryant's the starter there. Here is the interesting thing, because we talked about the player moving forward. I have not, until summer winded down and fall camp opened up, I had been overlooking Zarek Cooper. So let me pitch this back to you, because one of my well-placed sources in the upstate of South Carolina told me that maybe I was overlooking Zarek Cooper as the guy. Hunter Johnson certainly has had all of the accolades. Kelly Bryant seems like the safe pick. Why is Zarek Cooper being overlooked in this, and why should we take him more seriously as somebody that can come in and really make a difference for the Tigers? Because I think the third answer, the third question, can whoever is the quarterback lead them to the national championship? I think that answer is no. I think that Clemson falls short of the college football playoff because of a couple trap games on their schedule, one of which being at NC State on Halloween weekend after they escaped NC State. When NC State missed a 33-yard field goal lined up in the middle of the field when it was 17-17 in regulation. But karma aside, I think that this is just a year where it's going to be tough to beat Florida State because Florida State's one of the best teams in the country. So why am I and maybe some other people overlooking Zarek Cooper in this Clemson quarterback debate?
Because he's the man in the middle. Because he is, he's not the upperclassman. He's still young. He's athletic, but he's not a freak. If you're not going to go with the true freshman Hunter Johnson, then why are you going to go with the redshirt freshman with barely any more experience? I actually think the guy is Kelly Bryant. I don't think Hunter. I was never as high on Hunter Johnson as we had him ranked.
Yes, I love this. This is like one of my favorite things about doing podcasts with you, Barton. Is like because your takes are so like unique and sharp to you, and it's not the 24/7 Sports composite. It is not the 24/7 Sports consensus. Like, you got an eye for this. You played this game. You play college football. You've been scouting dudes for like a decade. Like, you know this. Like, I love the fact that you're off Hunter Johnson just because too many people are on it.
I know. So, I mean, with Hunter Johnson, he is talented without question. He's talented, and he's got an unbelievable arm and all that sort of thing. But I was never impressed with the way he handled pressure. I was never impressed with the way, you know, I saw him at big games throw interceptions. I saw him when the spotlight was the brightest struggle a little bit. And so I just don't know if he's got that sort of intangible it factor to be ready as a freshman. He could be ready eventually, but I don't think he's a fresh out of the box guy. And I want to take you back to Kelly Bryant's high school career too. This kid threw for 3,500 yards as a senior with 41 touchdowns. He rushed for another 720 yards. Like, this kid is talented. I also think, to answer the final question, if Kelly Bryant is the quarterback without question, and he gets the, you know, he has the coach's backing and he's not looking over his shoulder all year, I'm not predicting them to win a national championship, but my hunch is that Kelly Bryant is good enough for this team to win a national championship. Would you believe that Alabama, and I know Alabama lost to Clemson, but they didn't lose in this because of Jalen Hurts. They lost just because Clemson was a better team. So if you had replaced Jalen Hurts with this year's Kelly Bryant last year on Alabama's team, do you think Alabama would have still been in the national championship game? Because I do think that Clemson could be on that Alabama level defensively because of that defensive front.
Wow. No, I don't. I mean, I had this conversation with somebody this weekend. I just think that Deshaun Watson is one of the most unique college football players that we've seen in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, he went 28-2 in the last 2 years as a starter. Like, that's unbelievable. Like, he's special.
I agree. But before we move on, because I know we got a lot of questions to get to. So last point on this: as good as Deshaun Watson is, and he is an absolute beast, especially in the biggest games, especially in the brightest spotlight. But this weekend they were playing on ESPN Classic or whatever. They're playing the top 25 games of last year.
ESPNU's been running them games. I've got them all DVR'd right now.
I'm catching some Clemson games, and I'm being reminded, like, that dude was far from perfect during the regular season.
Oh, he threw mad dumb passes. He threw a bunch of dumb passes.
Dumb passes, overthrown, touchdown passes. Like, he was far from perfect. I give him all the credit in the world for being about perfect in the national championship game and when it all mattered. But, man, he left them open for some losses during the season. So I would suspect Kelly Bryant can be good enough, but man, it'll be. And the other thing too, before we move on, they're going to have to decide who's not in this race.
Ooh,
and cut it down from 3-2 and get these guys reps and figure it out, because if they're going to play three quarterbacks all the way up to whatever their opener is, Kent State, then that's going to be a problem. They need to get two guys and let them race it out.
Yeah, that Auburn game on September 9th is huge. Like, you can't be playing around.
They're ready to roll on that one.
All right, so speaking of the quarterback position, there is some confidence around LSU this season, and Danny Etling isn't doing it for me, but Darius Geis absolutely does.
Geis, another good gain and broken tackles. Geis out into the open, breaks another one, and he will score.
You might find in your local grocery store, in your local pharmacy, in your local Rite Aid, or whatever it may be, a really well-produced, stud-written CBS Sports, Beckett Sports, 24/7 Sports, Scout Sports SEC preview, where Darius Geis is one of the cover athletes. Barton wrote for it. Chip wrote for it. And my question here, because I think that the LSU optimism is based around a couple of things. Number one, we know for a fact that Dave Aranda, like, Barton, catch me on this one. True or false? Dave Aranda is one of the top defensive coordinators in the game. True?
No question.
And yes. Matt Canada's stock is rising because not only did he get it done at Wisconsin, but at Pittsburgh, he was able to feature even more than Connor. He was able to get James Connor involved. He was able to get Quadri Ellison involved. He was able to get Quadri Henderson involved. Like Matt Canada and Dave Aranda, you've got to think that LSU has a stud OC-DC combo, right?
Maybe the best in the country.
What happens if Darius Geis gets hurt?
Great question. And LSU has recruited well at running back. They do not have Darius Geis behind Darius Geis. Last year, they had Darius Geis behind Leonard Fournette.
Right, and that was the thing is, like, Fournette got banged up so much that, like, when Darius Geis came out, we were like, yo! But I don't think that, like, I'm very, very nervous about the number of intangibles that it takes for LSU to have a 10-win season. You know what I'm saying? Okay. Where it's like, okay, you're betting on a lot of things to all work out perfectly.
Chip, I'm ready for this one. I got this one. All right. A couple of things. Number one, I do not expect Darius Geis to break any of the records he set last year at LSU because I do not expect Darius Geis to get the stupid, insane workload that he got last year. This is what Matt Canada does. He gets his playmakers the football, but he spreads it around too. He's going to get touches to a lot of different people. He's going to have multiple backs in there that can get touches. He's going to get tight ends and receivers and shuffle passes and jet sweeps, and Darius Geis is not going to get a crazy workload. Okay, that's number one. So, and number two is, if he does get hurt, if he has a freak accident and he tears his Achilles or something like that, then I do think that Matt Canada is equipped to, again, get guys the football and make defenses and put them in compromising situations so that he's not necessarily leaning on the playmakers, but he's leaning on the scheme. That you can't do it all with that. You can't win a title with that, but you can certainly score some points. So I think that they can make do a couple games if they have to without Geis. Now, here's my other point. Danny Etling inspires nobody. I get it. I know. I understand. But I want to bring this to your attention.
Please do, because I mean, Barton, I am so limp for Danny Etling.
Okay, understood, man. And for good, you know, I don't expect you to be excited about Danny Etling, but I wonder, Chip, how excited you were about Nathan Peterman last year before the season.
Prior to him showing up, you got it. Like I was sitting in the Pitt offices prior to the 2016 season. Watching Matt Canada draw up jet sweeps, starting to call out blocking schemes because I was so excited about their O-line and so uninspired by the quarterback position. I'm with you. Like I didn't think Peterman was anything. But
2,200 yards passing as a junior, 61% completions, 20 touchdowns, and eight interceptions. That was Nathan Peterson's line as a junior after he had basically no stats to speak of in his career prior to that. His one start at Tennessee was an absolute disaster. Looked like he was an incompetent quarterback. Then he has a very mediocre junior year, and then he plays under Matt Canada for one season and gets drafted to the NFL draft. Okay? Now, I'm not saying Danny Etling's going to play in the NFL, but his stats are not that far off from what Danny Etling's were as a junior. 2,100 yards passing, 59.5% completion, 11 touchdowns, 5 interceptions in an offense that was as uncreative as it could ever be in a conference that plays as good a defense as anywhere in the country. I believe that Matt Canada is going to do wonders for Danny Etling, which will do wonders for Darius Geis, which will do wonders for the LSU offense. Call me a believer in Matt Canada, but I think that there's a real chance LSU is a fun, fun team to watch. Speaking of this weekend, Chip, I watched that Pitt-Clemson game. Man, it's a blast to watch that Pitt team. The creative ways they get the football to players, the different false indicators and motions and all kinds of stuff that they do to make it tough on defenses. I'm just telling you, man, LSU fans, they better wake up when they have the ball this year because it's going to be fun to watch.
It's I'm a Matt Canada believer. I'm with you. I'm just not a Danny Etling believer. Your evidence to convince me in Danny Etling was Matt Canada and not Danny Etling.
So, okay, let me give you one more Danny Etling nugget. All right, when Danny Etling I liked him coming out of high school. He played a horrible high school team. He took a beating every week, but he had a big arm and he was talented and he was tough. He goes to Purdue. He takes a beating every week, but he was still talented and he was still tough. But their team was terrible. When he transferred to LSU, I said, and everyone was like, "Oh, who's this like kind of nobody transferring from Purdue who just couldn't, you know, wasn't starting for a terrible team?" I said he was. I thought he was going to win a job. I thought he would win that starting job eventually if he got a fair shake. He got it. He won the job. He was very uninspiring, I admit, but he was better than what they had. I think he can improve from where he was last year. I do think there's a ceiling on him. Like, I think I'm not ready to give up on Danny Etling as a capable SEC quarterback.
All right. So
you don't sound convinced, but that's all right.
All right. Because you don't need to be like I understand the quarterback level in the SEC has improved across the board, but there's also a ceiling to my expectations in the SEC West when I believe that Alabama is that much ahead of everybody else. So there is that level of Danny Etling, if he is capable, like, can be Jarrett Lee good, you know?
Yeah, and that's the thing. Is like,
and that's not bad. That's, like, Jarrett Lee good is still playing for titles.
That's, I think, where the distinction is. Like, he doesn't have to be great. He's just got to be good. And I think that the offensive line and the running backs and the O coordinator will take care of the rest.
All right, cool. All right, so you got the next question. What's your question?
All right. Who's going to be the starting receiver in Michigan?
All right, we got like 9 names up here.
All right, I'll throw some at you. Kakoa Crawford, Tariq Black, Donovan Peoples-Jones, Nate Shinley, Grant Perry, Eddie McDoom, Nate Johnson, Oliver Martin, Nico Collins. It's a silly list. They're so talented.
I got Grant Perry as a name I recognize. I got Eddie McDoom as a name that Barton has thrown at me in the last week or so on this podcast. Like, Nico Collins sounds good because I'm a big Lou Reed fan and I really like some 60s like alternative art rock. Like what's the deal here? Because I have been ready to sell the idea that Michigan is ready to be good at the skill position. And from our podcast, I know for a fact that you are more confident in the Wolverines than I am. So sell me on not only who is starting at wide receiver, but sell me on the fact that they're going to be ready to give Wilton Spate some good options after a lot of receptions are gone. No more Chesson, no more Darbo, no more Jake Butt. Barton, sell me on this.
Okay. Look, I hear you. All right, but here's the thing. The reason why this is important is because Wilton Spate is kind of just a guy. He's not a put-you-on-his-shoulders quarterback. I've expressed to you my doubts about Wilton Spate. So he's going to need dudes on the outside. He's going to need playmakers. And I think this is one of the more talented wide receiving rooms in the country. There are just a bunch of names that nobody knows yet. But these are dudes that are absolutely, like, if they get the chance, they're studs. They lost 57 receptions for Amara Darboe. They lost 35 with J.U. Chesson, 46 with Jake Butt. But, you know, I think Tariq Black, Donovan Peoples-Jones are among the best true freshman candidates in the country at wide receiver. Kakoa Crawford, I think, has a chance to be really good. I'll go maybe Grant Perry, Nate Shinley, who's a walk-on among that group, and maybe Donovan Peoples-Jones jumping in there. But I guess the point of this question isn't necessarily who. It's just a matter of which of the three is going to step in and are they going to be ready to put serious production up? Because I still think this Michigan team is one of the most talented teams in the country. They're just one of the least experienced. And this is one of those spots, along with corner and defensive back, where they need guys, young guys, inexperienced guys, to step up and be bosses.
All right. So speaking of the defensive side of the ball, one of my questions, big question. We talked about it a little bit with the Big 12, but I want to break into it a little bit more. Oklahoma State, as we've gotten closer and closer to the season, as fall camp has opened, the vibe that they might have some 2011-type season, some 2011-type feelings, like Mason Rudolph, like looking good, James Washington back, like one of the best quarterback-wide receiver combos. There has not been, from what I've been able to tell, enough like good feelings behind the thought that Oklahoma State could have a championship level defense for people to jump on the Cowboys as a potential playoff dark horse. Like, when I'm looking at the very early projected playoff picture, not only is the Big 12 getting left out,
but Oklahoma State is not even the Oklahoma school that's getting included. So can Oklahoma State field a championship slash playoff level defense in the Big 12 this year? Barton, what do you think?
I don't know, man. My hunch is no.
And oh, man.
No, God, please, no. 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 No.
And look, I'm going to be the first to admit, like, there's a little bit of ignorance here in terms of I'm not familiar enough with their personnel to sit here and stand on the table and say, man, this group is going to get it done.
Listen, but, dude, hey, like, all right, so my boy Kyle Porter, who does the golf podcast, is Oak State. Like, he gets it. And he's got the same shruggy emoji that you do, man. Like, don't feel bad about that. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, he knows, like, he played baseball at Oklahoma State. He helps us out on the college football side, covering some Oklahoma State stuff from time to time. And even he's like, yeah, we'll see. You know, like, this is a weird spot for the Cowboys, because we're excited about Mason Rudolph. We're excited about James Washington. We love Mike Gundy's mullet. But this defense, man, I got no confidence.
I agree. And it goes back to our Big 12 talk too. If this was this defense in last year's Big 12, I might be a little more confident that they could be good enough to get to the playoffs. But I just think this Big 12 is better enough that it's going to be a really tough task. There's teams that can score points. There's also teams that'll play defense and make your defense go back out there and get some stops. You know, I can't get confident in this defense yet. I'm going to try to watch the hell out of that Tulsa Oklahoma State game. I might watch Oklahoma State South Alabama. I'm going to dig into Oklahoma State the first 3 weeks of the season, because I want to figure it out. But right now, I don't see it yet.
Hey, bro, that Tulsa Oak State game is going to be one hell of a workout for Oak State's DBs.
Hey, and we'll find out something.
Right,
about
yeah,
Oklahoma
no, no
State's
doubt,
DBs
because
too.
Phillip Montgomery's going to come. Yeah, dude, Phillip Montgomery's going to come out here ready to roll, son. He like that is going to be 7-on-7 football right there. It's like that game. And then like Carolina Cal is another good early game. That'll be some good 7-on-7 work.
That's a sneaky fun game to watch that opening week. Like that's one to put on your schedule. It might be over midway through the third quarter, but it's going to be at least a fun half of wide open football.
All right. Throw a question at me.
All right. Wisconsin.
Ooh.
If they are going to win a Big Ten title and get to the college football playoffs, do they have a defensive coordinator in his second year ever coaching football to get it done? Jim Leonard, the former defensive back, NFL punt return extraordinaire, in his second year coaching is the defensive coordinator of Wisconsin. I think I've got that number. I think he was a DB last year in his first year, and maybe hung around Dave Aranda the year before that just to get a feel for things in Wisconsin as like a volunteer assistant. But essentially, he's 3 years into his career as a coach after playing in the NFL. He's like 38 or something. And this is a third DC in 3 years at Wisconsin. And it's almost like it doesn't matter if Brett Bielema is the coach. It doesn't matter if Paul Chryst is the coach. If Gary Anderson is the coach. It doesn't matter who the DC is. Wisconsin always looks like Wisconsin. But I got to wonder, Chip, is it going to catch up to them this year? This will be really fascinating to watch a young DC go to work this year.
Yeah, I think that the young DC is not going to be a huge issue yet, but that's only because they've still got so much in place from what was like the Wisconsin quarterback situation last year was bad.
Wasn't pretty.
Like Wisconsin offense in general last year, not great. And we're still talking about a team that was playing at a championship level. There's some turnover on the personnel side. I don't think there's turnover on the culture side. I think that the challenge for Jim Leonard won't be in 2017. I think it's going to be moving forward, and I think it's going to be on the recruiting trail to make sure that they've got the bodies to be able to replace, to be able to replace like all Big Ten players all through the front seven and in the secondary. Like this year won't be the year that things get really, really challenging, but I've got faith in Jim Leonard. Where are you at?
Well, I see about eight projected senior starters on defense. They returned seven from last year's team on defense. I agree. Like any other team, I'd say this is concerning. I'd be like, this is, I don't know what to think about this, but it's just Wisconsin, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't. Barry Alvarez is the AD, and nothing else matters. I mean, Paul Chryst is proven to be a really good coach, and Wisconsin is going to do Wisconsin. And I'm with you. I think they're not changing the scheme. They're not changing the system. It's basically a similar system to what they've been running. So,
like, just because Wilcox is gone doesn't mean that they're going to flip things around.
Right. But it you know, and Jim Leonard's been around a lot of football. But when the heat is on Saturday nights, you know, we'll see if he's got it. But I expect he probably does. And I think Wisconsin continues to be one of my favorite teams this year.
All right. This was one of your questions. So I'm going to throw it back at you just because we are, we're starting to go up against the time. And I know that you had it on your mind. So Marcel Harris, this injury, where are we at in terms of Florida's secondary, not only for this season, but after having the Gators secondary be something that I kind of feel like we could count on for basically dating back to the Muschamp days, you know, like what are we expecting from Florida's back defensive backfield, especially in the context of an SEC East? And we will go out on this leading into Wes Rucker talking about Tennessee, but you know, how does the Marcel Harris injury shape the way that we look at Florida and the SEC East in general going into the 2017 season?
Well, I think the Marcel Harris injury is big, and
I think you might think it's bigger than I do. That was the thing, is I thought that when I saw your text, I was like, oh man, you're right. You know, like I hadn't thought of it that way, and that's why I'm glad we do this podcast, by the way. But like, I just had thought that the status quo is that the Gators were good on the backside.
Well, I mean, last year it was really about the defense. Their front, their defensive line was great. Their linebackers had two borderline first rounders. Their secondary had three borderline first rounders. And now they lose Marcel Harris, who, guess what? Their leading tackler last year wasn't Gerard Davis or Marcus May or Alex Anzalone. It was Marcel Harris.
I didn't know Nick Washington until Nick Washington was awesome, you know?
You're right. No, you're right. And Nick Washington may step in there, and Chauncey Gardner may back in, you know, may move back and play on the back end. But they've got Michigan right out of the shower in the morning on week one. And I'm not as worried about who's going to be back there in defending the pass. I just know Michigan is going to make Florida and whoever's playing safety prove to them he's tough enough. And it's going to be about fitting the run game. And I guess this floor, I'm waiting for Florida to take a step back. And I don't know if this is the year it's going to happen. I suspect there may be a step back coming eventually, but if they don't take a step back this year, man, forget it. Like I'm picking Florida like indefinitely to win the East, because there's some holes. I think there's a little bit of a backward slide. And I think Marcel Harris matters to this defense. So we'll see what happens, but I don't know. To me, that is a meaningful loss.
That's it. You think?
I mean, yeah. I think Marcel Harris matters in this defense, and I think they got Michigan week one.
All right, so who do you think? Do you think Malik Zaire is going to be the starting quarterback there?
Yes, I do think Malik Zaire is going to be the starting quarterback there.
I know, and I'm so uninspired by it.
Uninspired. That does not do anything for me.
Yeah, like Malik Zaire might as well be he might as well just be another like, oh, and yeah, Jordan Scarlett's going to be okay. 80 yards a game. Like
he's just another guy on offense that's like, okay. They got a couple receivers, Antonio Callaway and Tyree Cleveland.
Dude, Tyree Cleveland, I've been waiting for that guy to be nasty for a long time. Antonio Callaway obviously is a phenomenal talent, but like I'm with you, man. If Florida gets it done this year, I'm done picking against them.
I agree. Yeah, this is going to be a really interesting year to watch them. But the other quarterback battle I think that's really interesting is the Miami quarterback battle. Like that one, talk about an uninspiring quarterback battle. Look, I have very little opinion one way or the other on Malik Rozier and Evan Sheriff's. Like, I think those guys can play. Malik Rozier has started, but Miami, I think, could be starting a true freshman by midseason in the Kosi Perry.
Oh, dude, Kosi Perry is the dude. It's just a question of when he's ready. Like, and the thing about the Sheriff, like, man, that, like, you're not going to – the only thing that makes Malik Rozier, if he is inaccurate with the ball, then it goes to Sheriff's. And it, the only thing that makes Sheriff's a big problem is if he gets stuck in third and long, because I think that he can hand the ball off to Mark Walton or be able to dump it off to an Amon Richards and hopefully, like, good. Like, the Miami quarterback position to me, Barton, is 100% dependent on what we are expecting from that defense, from Manny Diaz and from a crew of Miami linebackers that ended up starting as true freshmen. Like Shaq Quarterman, the rest of that group, they came in and they just said, you know what? Forget all y'all. This is our defense. Like, Chad Thomas is ready to break out. Like, this is a front seven that I think is one of the best in the ACC. Like, not quite on the Florida State Clemson level yet, but certainly right up there with NC State as, like, a top four group.
Yeah, I think in some ways this is a survival year for Miami, because they got to get to eight, hopefully nine wins, but they're not going to win anything meaningful. They're not going to win a national championship this year. They're probably not going to win an ACC championship this year. And I think I think the quarterback position is the reason why. But if they can get through this year and get to nine wins, hopefully for them, then they've got a chance next year. If maybe Nikosi Perry has gotten some snaps, gotten a couple starts, improved as the year went on, then next year could be something special. Because then all those guys that played as freshmen are back. Amon Richards is back, a receiver. They got plenty of talent in the backfield. Next year could be the U is back type of year. And I in some ways, for the sake of college football, hope that we get to see Nikosi Perry and hope that he's at least solid, like at least acceptable out there.
All right. Well, speaking of quarterback battles, we are about to get Wes Rucker weighing in on the Tennessee quarterback position and other questions. So because we are talking about big questions, you know, we're going to the premier expert, 24/7 Sports. Barton, we got to welcome Wes Rucker to the house. The first 24/7 Sports team writer to the show. Wes, how we living, man?
Pretty well, although I gotta tell you, I hope there's better headliners coming after me. I gotta say that much.
You're the great one, Wes. Come on, man. And you're down there in Knoxville where there's all kinds of craziness going on. No one knows what to expect. We got boots on the ground. We started off this show to talk about big questions around college football. And, man, there's not many bigger questions. Many more teams, I guess, with more questions is a better way to put it than University of Tennessee. So, man, let's dig in. Like, what's – I think right from the top – you got to begin at the quarterback. I mean, where do things stand? You know, my assumption is that Quentin Dormady is going to be the starter. But, of course, you know, Jared Guarantano's got all kinds of hype about how talented he is. There's even some consideration about a two-quarterback system, it seems like, is trickling out. So give us kind of the lay of the land about the quarterback situation and what you expect this fall.
Well, you're right, Barton. This is a team full of questions. That's in an SEC East full of questions. But in that quarterback position at Tennessee, certainly, you know, one of the most interesting ones there. Now, I think personally, I think that it's going to be Dormady, and I think that exiting spring camp, I continue to hear behind the scenes that Dormady was probably the leader there, and I don't think anyone wants to say it publicly, because you've seen, like at the situation with Bama last year, that a quarterback will occasionally pick up his ball and go home if he's not the starter even during a season. So, yeah, I mean, I think they want to make sure both guys are happy and both guys are committed to the program long term. But I still think that Dormady is probably the clubhouse leader there, and I don't think it's a situation that he's just a quote game manager guy. I don't really like that label. I don't want to sound like Saban here, but I don't really love that label. Because it sounds like it's a criticism when it's not. But even if that were a criticism, I don't think it would apply to Quentin Dormady. I think he's a guy who has a big-time arm, can make every single throw in the book, 6'4", 230, great presence, just kind of looks like a central casting quarterback that you would order if you were doing a movie about the SEC. I think there's a lot of ability there, and I think he's a better athlete than people think too. I think he could pleasantly surprise some people.
Why do you think that he would – be surprised? Like, what makes Quentin Dormady fly below the radar right now, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, the short answer to that, Chip, is got to be just the recruiting rankings. That's, you know, and I don't blame people for feeling this way, because I'm going to toot our own horn here for our network at 24/7 Sports. But our guys, you know, we're making this thing much more of a science than it ever has been before. You know, it's always going to be an art, but we're making it a better science. We're getting this stuff right more often than not. And when you see a guy come in as the number one dual threat quarterback prospect in the nation, people are going to get excited. You know, people deserve to get excited about that. I don't blame them for that. And Dormady was a guy who, you know, was injured his senior year of high school, or his junior year rather, I think, and just did not, you know, he didn't play at the best high school in Texas. He didn't have a great offensive line in front of him. He just didn't, he never kind of, you know, blew up at people when he was a prospect in certain ways. But I think ever since he showed up at Tennessee, he's been kind of a wow guy behind the scenes. And I think he's a guy who, you know, I could be wrong. He can go out there and just completely, you know, mess down his leg. But I think that he's a guy who's going to go in there and play pretty well.
Well, and, you know, to follow up on the rankings thing, like, people forget, like, Quentin Dormady was actually a four-star 24/7 Sports. So to think he's going to be pretty good, you know, he's we have expectations for him too. It's just, that's just a testament to, you know, how hyped Guarantano was. And I want to follow up a little bit on Jared. I mean, is where are we at in his progression? Because it feels like, just sort of the sense I get, is that Quentin Dormady is the more sure thing, the safer bet right now. But Guarantano's still got all kinds of talent. Is he, how close do you get the sense that he is to being ready to go? And how much of that has to do with sort of his ability to lead the team and his ability to take charge from the, you know, the mental side and the leadership side of things?
Well, I think that if you were to go out there and just watch some B-roll of practice, or just watch the first few periods of practice, you would think that Guarantano was the guy. He's the guy who pops out at you athletically. You know, he's every bit of 6'4", 200, has an absolute cannon of a right arm, spins the ball beautifully. You know, when you just watch them do the routes on air and some of those, you know, one-on-one drills, he looks really, really good. There's no doubt about that. That's where you see that ranking. You know, that's why you can justify that, because you look at him and you go, wow, you know. But then I think the more defenders you put on the field, I think the looser he gets with the ball. That's been the problem in the past. And you know, when you get to 7-on-7, you get a better feel than you do against one-on-one. And then when you get 11-on-11, you get a better feel. And then when you get 11-on-11 in pads, you get a much better feel. And I think that Dormady's just safer with the ball. I don't really like cliches, but the older guys just kind of taking better care of the ball. And I think that's something that if Guarantano can do that. And the other thing is, Dormady is a quieter guy by his nature, but he's a really good leader. He just kind of walks in a room. He's got that good presence. He's confident, but he's not cocky. He'll pull out guys off to the side and talk to him. He knows his teammates, knows their families. He's just kind of that program kind of guy. And I think Guarantano just has a little bit of a ways to go there. And I think that's more of a reflection of the good things Dormady's done than anything bad Garantano's done. It's just that Dormady's the older guy, and I think he acts like it.
You've got a staff under Butch Jones that has done a good job of getting high quality recruits and bringing them to Knoxville. But you've also had a couple seasons where injuries have plagued the Vols, and where you look at the window of when Tennessee was expected to win the SEC East, even projected at media days before, sometimes you could look at the injury issues as a reason why they haven't been able to fulfill those expectations. Where do you think those players who maybe have seen the field a little bit earlier than expected, like, what is the mindset of those guys? Because there is a line of thinking, and something that Barton and I have discussed on this podcast, is like, Tennessee might be a team that could sneak up on you. And I don't know, looking at the schedule, whether or not you're going to feel confident for them to really break out in a national way in terms of breaking to double-digit wins. But there are a lot of high-quality players that Butch Jones and his staff have brought in that have gotten to see the field early. Do you think that gives them a little bit of an edge, particularly when you get into an SEC East where, like you mentioned earlier, a whole bunch of questions all across the division?
Oh, there's no question about it. And I think the simplest way I can put it is this. You know, Tennessee has been beaten up by injuries the past couple of years, and that has had a direct impact on the team. That's not an excuse. That's just a fact of life. But I do think this. I think when coaches talk about being in a place for, you know, a third year, fourth year, fifth year, the longer that you're at a program, the more you start to build what you want to have built from the beginning. And Tennessee, the past couple of years, has had a first-team lineup. If everybody's healthy, they can scare you. But when you start taking guys off here and there and guys get injured, they don't really have that kind of program depth that a place like Ohio State or Bama usually has, where, you know, you can lose a couple guys here and there, but there's just a lot of talent behind them, and there's a system and a philosophy and a comfort. Tennessee has not, in the first couple of years that Butch Jones was there, he was recruiting all these great players, and they had to go play immediately. And I think they've done a good job targeting guys. And I just think I was looking at it like going into preseason camp, maybe the top two middle linebackers on that team are guys like Darren Kirkland Jr., Daniel Batuli. They're both hurt to start camp. They're not there. But when you're Tennessee, yeah, and you can roll out other guys. You can roll out, you know, like a Will Ignat out there. You can throw a jumper out there, Cortez McDowell, you know, Dylan Bates. You can start throwing out five, six, seven guys. And they're good players. You know, the last couple of years, the last decade at Tennessee, when you've seen the starters on starters, you go, "Huh, that team looks pretty good." Then you look at the twos and you go, And then you look at the threes and go, "Is this even SEC football anymore?" This is where Tennessee's come a long way, I think. And I think I've noticed that a lot just the first couple of days of this year's camp, that they do have more depth there. They have more options. They have more guys that can come scare you when you're not, you know, when you're not seeing their best, you're still seeing pretty good. And that's what championship kind of contenders need to have. And I think Tennessee, you know, with bringing in a guy like Rock Gullickson, the strength coach, spent a great deal of time in the NFL, was a really respected guy there. That was a really good get for Tennessee. And I think that when you start stacking classes the way they have, and you start, you know, kind of changing your strength and conditioning program to fit more modern needs, I think you start to see a team that looks like an actual program more than a team.
Now, Wes, like, so here's my thing with Tennessee, and Chip talked about it a little bit, but in order for Tennessee, I actually, Tennessee's got a chance to be really good this year because I know how much talent they have on the roster. When I watch your videos from GoVols247 and watch the B-roll.
Yo, shout out GoVols247. Go check out GoVols247. We'll yeah.
We can get.
Yo, when I watch the film, like, those guys look like, like you said, they look like SEC players. The talent's there. I've seen these guys in high school. They're all ranked high. The talent's there. But I think what we missed last year was that team had some give up in them. Like, they had some, they didn't really have some of their biggest grinders, I guess, got hurt. You know, there were some young guys that had to step up. Maybe they weren't ready mentally. So I guess, you know, my question for you, I think this team could be really good, but they've got to have a chip on their shoulder. They got to be gritty. They got to be tough. And I think that they're sort of overlooked in an underdog team right now. So I guess my question to you is, you know, you got boots on the ground, you see these guys, you talk to them, and you can't really tell until there's a real game. But do you get any sort of sense that this team is different from a mentality standpoint, from a you know, something to prove standpoint? Can you tell that yet?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, Barton, because, you know, last year Tennessee just didn't have a championship mentality. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember I'm probably showing my age here. I started covering this program back when Philip Fulmer was the coach, and they were really good. And Tennessee, every year there were a couple games. It was against a Kentucky or a Vanderbilt or South Carolina. They'd go out there and play like just slaw. They would just be terrible. But they would do just enough to win because they were winners, and that's what winners do. They figure out a way to win when guys are hurt, when they're sore, when they're not at their best. And last year against South Carolina and Vanderbilt, even with all those injuries, Tennessee had no excuse. It needed to win those games, and it just didn't have the toughness to do it. And I think that's something that was a little bit of a humble pie for some of these guys. I think this team has, as best I can tell, has a little bit less of a sense of entitlement, maybe. And I don't mean that last season's team was, you know, just so full of itself all the time, but you had some personalities who maybe the shine was a little bit too much for them. And I think you got some guys now, some upperclassmen who have tasted that feeling, and it's sour. When you beat Georgia and Florida and you don't win the SEC East, man, that's like you're really celebrating, but you're not, because you didn't win anything. You can win games. Can you win a championship? And I think that coming up short like that in a way that they did, I think that rubbed a lot of these guys the wrong way. Now, do they have the leadership to go out there and make that happen and keep that mentality when they've gotten a little bit bruised, when they've gotten a little beat up? That's when you can tell. You can always tell a front runner when things start going badly, and there's always going to be adversity. And does this team have it? I could see it, but they're going to have to go out there and prove it. Last year I fell for it and I picked them to win the East. And
I did too.
I'm not ready to do that with this team until I see more. You know, Florida just grinded out the East the last couple of years, just, you know, found a way go to LSU, win those games, just grind it out, win ugly. Tennessee didn't do that. And until Tennessee goes out and does that, it's going to be hard for me to pick Tennessee to win the East.
All right, so what about the champions of life? Like, we've got this weird situation where Butch Jones has become, in the college football culture, a little bit of a lightning rod for commentary. And whether that is from, like, the jokes to the actual analysis or just a reaction to the fact that he is taking this super optimistic view, and the champions of life and everything else that comes with that view of the world, like, where does that trickle down to the roster? Because, like you just mentioned, this is a team that needs to be able to find a way. Like, no, if you were to rank, for example, Dennis Dodd, he does his hot seat rankings. Kevin Sumlin's at the top of the hit list right now in the SEC. I don't think that Butch Jones is anywhere close to the Kevin Sumlin level in terms of where people are looking at the jobs that are going to open up, but it is certainly a spot that I think it has a lot of national attention, particularly going into this year, particularly after the window has supposedly closed. Like, where does that optimism trickle down with the roster in terms of being able to have that edge, in terms of being able to have that championship mentality? Because you mentioned being able to, like, when you're playing like slaw, be able to get out. I like that phrase a lot. But, like, when you're able to get that win, like, where is this team in your opinion?
You know, that's a great question. And every time I start waxing poetically about this subject, Butch ends up getting angry with me. But, I'll go ahead and say it again. I think that, Dabo Swinney, a lot of other guys come out there and say those exact same phrases. They do, but those guys have won more games, and so they get less crap for it. That's basically the nicest way I can put it.
No doubt. Listen, I'm here in ACC country. Like, I've listened to Dabo preach all those same sort of I call them, Wes? I call them needlepoint phrases, because it's the same phrases that your grandma probably put on a needlepoint and framed up in their house one day. Mm-hmm. These are needlepoint phrases.
Yeah, there's, and again, there is some science to what they're doing there, because these coaches, it's amazing with the budgets they have and the things they can look at and study and have studied for them. And they know that players in this era, kids in this era, heck, I've got a brother who's a college senior and incredibly smart kid, doesn't read books. The attention spans are so short that if you can't get their attention with just a few words, you're probably not going to get their attention. And that's just how it is. So I think, to that extent, I think he's trying to reach the players that way. So I do understand that part of it. The problem is, I think Butch just has a problem publicly admitting anything is wrong ever. I think he views it as a sign of weakness. I think he just doesn't, you ask him specifically all the time, he'll tell you, I could have done something better. And then you say, okay, what could you have done better? And then he'll never give you a specific, because he just, the way he works in the public eye is that's just not how he rolls. He's not going to do that. But I think that he's a little bit different guy when he's actually coaching the team. And I think they see the fangs come out a little bit more. I think they see that the way that he'll challenge them. I think that part of it, I think it gets overblown because Butch puts himself in that position because of the way he acts publicly. He doubles down on things he shouldn't have said to begin with. He is who he is. And if it works, if you're winning, it sounds great. When things get tough, you start to get on your nerves a little bit. That's just how it is. And I don't think that he's in imminent danger of losing his job here or anything like that. I think when you look at where the program was 4 or 5 years ago and you look at it now, you go, I don't know why I'd fire that guy. But he puts himself in these positions because he says things he just shouldn't say, probably. And whether or not it's fair is totally irrelevant to the fact that that's what it is. It doesn't matter if it's fair. Fair's got nothing to do with it. Perception-wise, it is what it is, and it's going to make things tougher for him until he wins big.
One thing Butch has done a good job of is he's acknowledged where he's need to change, and he's been willing to change. And this coaching staff has turned over a ton. And after seeing the spring and being around the program in the summer, and now we're only a practice or two in this fall, but where are you noticing the biggest differences on the coaching staff? Like, what coach has initiated the most change, I guess, is the best way to phrase this. Like, are you noticing anywhere where, like, things feel totally different because of this particular coach?
I think it's a really good question, Barton. And I think if the cop-out answer would be that I think maybe strength coach Rock Gullickson.
That's not a cop-out. Yeah, that's a good one.
Just stands out at me. But when you look at the actual full-time, the football position, coaching staff, the coordinators, I don't know that I've ever covered a staff that has four former FBS head coaches on it. That's a lot. You got four guys on this team who have been a head coach at the FBS level, and you just don't see that very often. And I think that lends itself to a lot of questions being answered. That, you know, when you're a head coach, it feels like the loneliest job in the world. It really does. And, you know, things come across your desk every day that you've never had to answer before. And you're dealing with everything from your players to the players' obnoxious parents to, you know, university presidents and chancellors who speak a different language, not English sometimes. It's just kind of, they speak like, you know, they're just academic people. They're not real world people. And you run into all these different kinds of things. Players get in trouble. Players have problems in school. Someone fails a drug test. Someone's slacking in the classroom. You know, someone stays out too late and breaks curfew. You got to figure out how to handle every situation. And you just don't always have the answer. And when you got four head coaches on your staff, you got people who have answers. Even if you've never experienced it, they might have. And I think that makes everything feel a little smoother. Like, I never get the impression, you know, from watching their practice or watching just sort of the structure of the program, I don't ever think that they're disorganized. I think that they have a plan. And I think that helps a lot because that gives you a foundation feeling that lets everyone be secure in what they're doing. And you feel comfortable. You know who people are. You know, you kind of become a family. And families have their problems. They always do. But I think that the organization has gotten a lot better. And I think that, you know, you look at guys like Charlton Warren joining the staff, who's never been a head coach before, but he could be a head coach pretty soon. I like this guy a lot. He's got a great, you know, he spent 10 years on active duty in the Air Force, and then he became a coach. He was the captain of the Air Force Academy football team. You talk about character, you talk about responsibility, leadership. The guy's got all that stuff in spades. I think he's helped a lot with the defensive backfield. I think the quarterbacks have really enjoyed working with Mike Canales. I think a lot of these guys who have come in, just like the defensive line with Brady Hoke, I think these guys like their staff for the most part. I think they like their position coaches, and I think they trust their position coaches. And if the players don't trust the staff, you're going to have problems. And I think this group of players trust the staff a little bit better.
All right, Wes, I'm going to put your feet to the fire a little bit. So another reason, again, where I think this team's got a chance to be really good is, like, I look at the defensive starting lineup, and it's a bunch of – I think nine of the projected starters were four- or five-star guys. Like, the talent is absolutely there. But the flip side of that is these guys haven't shown up yet. So I'm going to say if I give you the names, Kyle Phillips, Khalil McKenzie, both five-stars, Jonathan Kongbo, five-star – those are three guys that, I mean, Okongbo, look, I don't know that we should have expected him to blow up year one, but the other guys, certainly, I think we would have expected to see more of by now. If I give you those three names, like, who are you going to put your monthly check on to bet, all right, this is going to be his breakout year. I think we got a pretty good shot that this guy, that the light turns on this year. Who's your pick?
Monthly check. Make it serious.
Now, if I knew he would stay healthy, I could say Kyle Phillips, but I don't know that he'll stay healthy because he's always had a hard time with that. So I'll say Kongbo. I think he's a guy who, he's back to playing defensive end, which, hey, I think he'd be an all-world three technique if he'd just keep the weight on and embrace that position. But he doesn't want to play there. He wants to play defensive end. And I think he can do that too. I think he can be a really nice player. But you mentioned those three names. I think the guy who gets the most sacks on this team might end up being another former top 24/7 prospect, and that would be defensive end Daryl Taylor. I think he is a really phenomenal athlete. I think off the edge he could wreak a lot of havoc. He's a kind of an alpha male mentality. I like that guy a lot. I think there's a chance he could lead the team in sacks. But between all those guys, it's hard to judge ends versus tackles because they just have different roles and ends always get bigger stats. But if I had to pick one, I guess I'd pick Kongbo.
Wes, what's the deal with Khalil McKenzie? Like, why has he not been a factor yet? Is it just all about injury? Is it all about staying in shape? What's he missing?
Well, you know, he got hurt last year, and that was tough because, you know, Shai Tuttle, who might be the most talented defensive lineman on this team, has had two catastrophic injuries the past 2 years, and he's still not fully cleared to get back. It might be early in the season, midway point of the season before he really gets out there. But with Khalil, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's times where I look at him and I think, man, you would be so good at guard. But, you know, they need him at defensive tackle, and he wants to play defensive tackle. And he's got the strength to pull it off. Now, I think that if he would – maybe if he were in a 3-4 and he was sitting on the nose, I think that long term in the NFL might be a better fit for him. But yeah, I mean, I think it's just been, you know, sort of staying healthy. I think it's been, you know, making sure that he's focused all the time, because he's a great kid, but, you know, he just sometimes he needs to be a little more focused. And I think he could, you know, maybe put in a little bit more work in the past in terms of improving his flexibility, his knee bend, those kind of things. But in terms of pure talent, yeah, he's got a lot of it. And I think he's going to be a good player. It's just that, and I said this right after Khalil McKenzie and Shai Tuttle got there, all the talk was about McKenzie before they got there. And then when they both got there, boy, you started hearing a lot more talk about Tuttle. And I think that was as much an indication that Tuttle was really good more than McKenzie was overrated. I don't think he's overrated at all, but I think he's a guy who could end up being a solid player. But yeah, I mean, it's was he ready for the spotlight as soon as he was put there? No, but most kids aren't.
All right, Wes, before we let you go home to pick out some paint colors, we got to talk about the over-under win total. One of the things that we've had a lot of fun doing here in the first episodes of the 24/7 Sports College Football Podcast has been going over or under on the Las Vegas win totals. So we've got a Tennessee team that has the Atlanta game against Georgia Tech. We are on the road against Florida, but you finish the season at home against LSU and Vanderbilt. And the over-under win total is 7.5. What is your record prediction for Tennessee this season?
Boy, this could change a lot over the next few weeks. But if you're asking me right now,
we are recording this right now on July 30th. So you can, I will timestamp this. We are going to post this on Monday. You can make whatever prediction you want, and we can change it as the season goes on.
The way that I keep, you know, I go into a season and I usually have a pretty good idea, or at least in my head, it sounds like a good idea. It might be a terrible idea, but I usually go into camp and then into a season with a pretty good feel in my head for what I think a team will be. And I've been all over the place with this team, maybe more than any team that I've ever covered. It's just, you know, would 10-2 shock me? No. Would 7-5 shock me? No, it wouldn't. Neither of those things would shock me at all. If I had to guess right now, I would say 8-4. And that's because I think, you know, it is what it is. Tennessee's got to play probably the top two teams in the West, and they're the only team in the East that has to do that. It is what it is. So I think those two are going to be losses. And then when I think you look at Georgia and Florida, maybe win one of those, lose one of those, and then maybe pick up another loss along the way. I think 8-4. I think 8-4 sounds about right. I think anything like 6-6, 7-5, that would maybe surprise me a little bit. If I had to guess right now, I think 7.5 is the perfect place to put the over under, and I would say over.
Ooh. I'm with you.
Ooh, Wes Rucker. Well,
hey, so if we're wrong, we're wrong together, brother.
Hey, we were wrong together last year, though. So. let's try to get one right this year, man.
Well, in fairness, no one's, I think, ever picked the SEC East champion correctly. I think the media is like over a million trying to do that.
The SEC East is so stupid. I hate the SEC East. I cannot figure it out. It's impossible to predict, but I do. And that in and of itself is a big reason why I think Tennessee could be really good, because
No one thinks it's going to happen this year. I mean, let's reach one consensus.
It's the only roster in the East that I think compares decently with Georgia's.
Oh, but see, that's the thing, Wes, is like, because everyone's on Georgia, the SEC East theorem says that that's going to be the one team that definitely won't win it, right?
Yeah, sorry, Florida. You know, the last 2 years you've been counted out and you won it anyway, and it looks like people are going to be counting them out again because they're going to pick Georgia. But I think it makes the most sense that Georgia would win the East, because I like the schedule a lot better, if nothing else, and I like sort of the proven skill guys there. But you know, Tennessee, Georgia, Florida, you know, any of those three, I would not be surprised. Now if it were someone else, that would surprise me a lot, but any of those three, that wouldn't surprise me.
Wes, you're the best. Thank you so much. We will be sure to get you back here on the 24/7 Sports College Football Podcast. Thank you. Go home. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
I'm gonna go pick out paint colors now. I'm really looking forward to it. If you're listening right now, Lauren, I'm really, really happy about all of this.
Be decisive, Wes.
Go gray or go home.